This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for our Week in Review, beginning with a new development in the long-running battle between the town of Dudley and the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester over a proposed cemetery. Today, they reached an agreement to build it.
This is a great day for Massachusetts, for the Dudley community, and for furtherance of understanding between various communities.
That's attorney Howard Cooper there, who represents the Islamic Society. The agreement allows the Islamic Society space for several thousand burial plots on 6 acres of property the group will now be allowed to purchase. Opposition to the Muslim cemetery had been so intense that it prompted a lawsuit and, separately, a U.S. attorney's civil rights investigation. So with us in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's big news is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Good to see you, Tom.
Good to see you.
Happy holidays preemptively, I'm going to wish you here.
Thank you.
And also with us today is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, happy early holidays and good to see you too.
Same here, Meghna.
All right, let me just get a first quick reaction from both of you about the fact that this very contentious battle in Dudley at least seems to have come to something of a conclusion. Tom, your take?
Well, it's good to see that finally Dudley do right.
Oh, wah, wah,
sorry about that. So I've been following this one for a while, and I think there was almost no question that if this had been a Catholic cemetery or a Jewish cemetery, you would not have seen this kind of reaction, this kind of issue heightened up so high. I do not know at this point who were the bad actors here in Dudley, whether it was just some citizens who were prejudiced or whether it really was the town government, but this went on way too long, ultimately had to go to court. It's good to see that, you know, quite frankly, in a season of joy and so on, that finally these people are able to come to some resolution.
Arlene, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's been a sad series of events around this with a good conclusion today, thankfully. The ACLU spent a lot of time on this case. Howard Cooper, the ACLU attorney, Sarah Wunsch, the attorney general weighed in. As you mentioned, Carmen Ortiz's office weighed in. There were, in fact, many anti-Muslim statements that were made by folks in the course of the proceedings on this in the town of Dudley. Not all the people in Dudley felt that way. There were plenty of good, positive, open-minded, fair folks, but there were some real enmity an anti-Muslim sentiment that was discussed many a time. And,
Arlene, can I just jump in here? Because we have some tape from some of the Dudley Town meetings that were held when they were discussing the cemetery. Because neighbors earlier in this year had raised concerns. There was a range of concerns, some of them about the size and scale of the cemetery. Others had worries about potential drinking water contamination. But we've got some tape here from one of the town meetings. And in it, you're going to hear a Dudley resident, Jared Manzi. He had a different opinion. And again, this was at one of the meetings that drew many hundreds of people.
Why not go bury your dead at a Christian cemetery? Why do you need your own cemetery if you're willing to violate jihadi law?
So that was one view from a Dudley Town meeting earlier this year. But I have to say also that we have a tape here from Dudley Town Administrator Greg Baluconis. He spoke on behalf of the town selectman back in August, saying that he didn't think that the town was doing anything wrong.
The town feels as though it didn't violate anyone's religious rights, including the Islamic societies. And we don't feel that our practices discriminate against anyone on the basis of religion or religious denomination.
Well, Carmen Ortiz's office, you know, looked into that to see whether or not that was true. That made
That's
it national
right.
news. But Arlene,
right.
pick up your thought there.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester was put through more hurdles than anyone else would have been for seeking a cemetery. No one ever worries about the contamination of water for a Christian cemetery or for any other kind. So I think there were plenty of good people in Dudley who were trying to be, or in fact were, open-minded, but there were folks who were ill-intended from the start. And one of the attorneys at the ACLU, you know, contacted me today and said, you know, this is a great resolution, today's announcement, a great resolution in the Trump era of hostility towards Muslims.
I think that's right. I mean, I think this is just an isolated case, but it really does speak somewhat more large, you know, to kind of the larger issues we're going to be dealing with over the next few years. You know, are we really building walls? Are we really, you know, letting people in on the basis of religion or not, you saw in a little microcosm here in Dudley what some of that can lead to. And so I guess it's a good sign that in Dudley people were able to turn back that, quite frankly,
right,
bigoted tide.
And that a resolution was—they did come to a resolution.
A seasonally appropriate resolution.
Right.
I do like actually hope the stories that end hopefully, especially at the end of this year. Well, but as we mentioned earlier, this got put into the national sort of news cycle, or got national attention was brought to it when U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz's office decided it was going to launch a civil rights investigation into what was happening in Dudley. One of the many high-profile things that Carmen Ortiz has done in her tenure as Massachusetts U.S. attorney, and this week she announced that she is stepping down from that post. Here she is speaking to WBZ-TV about the decision.
Now that my tenure is coming to an end, I feel that it is time for me to do other work. It was time for someone else to serve in this capacity.
So Ortiz was appointed by President Obama. She was the first woman and first Latina ever to hold the job. But she made a lot of news herself here in Massachusetts with the cases that she tried. So let me start with you, Tom, your take on Ortiz's tenure as U.S. attorney here.
So I think in general, we're going to think of her tenure as a really strong one. She took on some really high profile cases, the Bulger case, the Marathon bombings. She was certainly in the news an awful lot. I think the downside of her tenure had to do with some of the public corruption investigations. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't really fault her for doing that, because that's really the role of the feds. Within the state, you just don't see a lot of people really getting excited about investigating the people they work with. You need the feds to do this. But the problem that she had is several of those investigations really were leaning too hard on kind of weak federal law, and which is why she had a major one reversed just this week, which was with the probation department.
With the O'Brien case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Arlene, your thoughts?
Well, I think Tom's right. She's a bit of a mixed bag. She's done some very good work, but she has been uniformly, it seems, criticized for doing overzealous prosecutions and overreaching. And I agree on some of the public corruption cases were perfect examples where she did, in fact, in my opinion, overreach. The case, the probation scandal that Tom just mentioned, the Sal DeMacy case, seeking this extremely long sentence, perhaps even an inappropriate prosecution, many people think, not moving for a compassionate release years earlier. The Walsh administration going after two employees.
That's still ongoing.
And that's still ongoing because they were trying to get union labor hired at some music festivals to do construction work in town. So for some of her less high-profile cases, I'm told that she made a lot of very good decisions, but a lot less so in the high-profile, media-driven ones.
But Tom says it's the job of the federal prosecutor to do
really
exactly
is.
This.
It's the job to go after things appropriately, but the question is if you're stretching federal law, interpretation of federal law.
Right. And so the probation department is actually a great example of that. I mean, when you saw that reversed by the federal court, you know, the federal court made it quite clear that what was going on probably was illegal under state law, just not illegal under federal law. And, you know, the regret there, to be frank, is that with that being reversed, people are going to think, now it's fine to just do, you know, to ignore personnel law, hire people on the basis of favoritism rather than merit. And that really should not be the lesson to be drawn out
of
this.
Well, also, speaking of potential prosecutorial overreach, there's another case, the case of Aaron Swartz, internet activist,
right,
who he was arrested in 2011 for hacking a server of academic journals at MIT and making them public, charged with a felony. He later on ended up taking his own life, and many people said that was, they wonder if it was due in part to Carmen Ortiz putting the full force of the U.S. Attorney's Office on him for what many see as not necessarily a felony-deserving charge.
Right, and she really has, I think, subsequently voiced some regret over her role in that. I mean, I think it's exactly right that was something that should have been handled not through the criminal process, but in some other manner.
Mm. There is that one. And you're right. She has spoken of some regrets around that case. But even on the patronage case, you know, there have been a lot of statements, from the courts that not all unappealing conduct is criminal. So you might not like patronage, but that doesn't mean that it is illegal. And you know, she took the Bob DeLeo, named him as an unindicted co-conspirator. That hurt the man's reputation. For a very decent and thoughtful guy, by the way, but he and other legislators have lived for 6-7 years now under this cloud of suspicion. this is legal vindication for them, but that still hurt their reputations.
Yeah, he's certainly not happy that she's leaving. Well, unhappy, I should say.
Unhappy. Well, I want to play a little bit more tape from U.S. Attorney Ortiz here, because this comes in May 2015 at a press conference following the guilty verdict for Jahar Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber. I want to play it because it gives us a sense as to, you know, whether you're a critic of her or supporter of her take of the purpose and how the purpose of the law and how the law should be enacted.
Even in the wake of horror and tragedy, we are not intimidated by acts of terror or radical ideals. On the contrary, the trial of this case has showcased an important American ideal that even the worst of the worst deserve a fair trial and due process of law.
So that was U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz in May of 2015. But let me ask both of you, the question now is, who is going to be her successor? Who's going to be the new Massachusetts U.S. attorney? Because usually it's, what, the governor or a senator that would recommend who that person should be to the president?
But sounds like patronage to me.
Recommend. But right now we have two Democratic senators and a governor who we're told that the president-elect hasn't asked the Baker administration for any help in identifying potential candidates. So
yeah, I don't think we're going to be getting Charlie Baker having a lot of influence on the Trump administration for quite some time. Given that he refused to vote for Trump and was very vocal about that. So there's a number of possible people out there. I wonder if Michael Sullivan might come back.
Wow. I've wondered the same thing, actually, the way he's been out there.
Have we had U.S. attorneys have second takes at it?
I don't know, but, you know, there's always time for a first.
Okay. Well, we spoke about the actual Boston Marathon bombing and the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev under Ortiz's tenure. I want to shift gears here and talk about a fictional take on that actual event that happened here in Massachusetts, because the new movie, Patriots Day, was released this week. It stars Mark Wahlberg, Bostonian Mark Wahlberg. And let's play a clip here. This is a scene where Wahlberg's character, he plays a Boston police officer, and he's arguing for the release of photos that law enforcement had of the two people who were then the suspected bombers.
Right now, Boston's working against us. Yeah, that's normal. You got a murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. You release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen. Trust me. You gotta start letting Boston work for us, I'm telling you.
That's a scene from Patriots Day, starring Mark Wahlberg. It's got a whole variety of reviews. Ty Burr at The Globe basically said, at best, it's, quote, unnecessary. At worst, it's vaguely insulting.
Ouch.
What do you think?
Ouch. It's a little harsh, but I understand the sentiment. You know, I listened to Wahlberg talk about the film and why he made it, and one of the lines he's repeated several times now, which I think is quite legitimate, he said someone was going to make the movie, and no matter what. And they might have exploited it more, or exploited it, period, and then I'm saying more. So to the extent that that was going to happen, you know, the nature of these things is that artistic license allows you to make composite characters, as some critics have been unhappy with, putting, you know, embodying in one policeman who happened to be played by Wahlberg the all the brilliant insights and being at all the important scenes and moments in the drama. But that artistic license is always somewhat painful for some of the people involved. There was the police officer, Dennis D.J. Simmons, who, you know, died from his injuries a year later. Mm-hmm. It's got to be very painful to his family, right? Yeah. There have been articles about that, and for his not even being mentioned in passing in the film. Films like this will always leave out important details, as do, quite frankly, the books. You know, in the same-sex marriage debate, since it happened in Massachusetts, there've been, and across the country, there have been a number of pieces of nonfiction written, and each and every one of them has been controversial because they don't include X, Y, and Z, or they omit this, or they make this appear the wrong way. So the recording of history is always challenging.
Right. Before we get to you, Tom, I just want to play a little bit more tape, because Arlene had mentioned how Mark Wahlberg said someone was going to make it. So it best that it was him because he has some fealty to Boston, being from Dorchester. He told us at Radio Boston that he really felt a sense of responsibility.
If anybody is going to be held accountable in this community, it's me.
Yeah.
Everybody else can kind of go back to their homes in California, wherever else. You know, I come here to visit my mom. I want to go to the Boys Club. I want to go to my neighborhood. And I want to be able to hold my head up and walk the streets with pride.
Tom, I'm curious. I mean, I don't object and I don't dispute Wahlberg's own sense of personal responsibility here, but also, like, it's Hollywood. They're making money off of this about things that actually happen to real people who live in our community.
Right. I mean, if Mark Wahlberg saying a local has to make it then raises the question, why'd he make the movie about Deepwater Horizon? You know, I mean, it's kind of an absurd argument. Yes, someone was going to make it. And probably, by the way, someone's going to make another version of it. In fact, another version is being made of it. We're going to see several movies about this. There's going to be a lot of money made, and it looks like there's going to be a lot of money made out of this one as well. I have not seen the movie, so I hesitate to sort of try to judge what's going on here. But everything I have read about it, and the most offensive thing about it really is this notion that the Mark Wahlberg fictional character is there at every turning point, as Arlene said. And I think one of the things that really misses is the sort of chaotic nature of the entire process, that it was, if we got to this solution, we got to the capture through the actions of a lot of individual men and women rather than one character who somehow was able to tie the whole thing together.
Right. And I mean, since we all lived it, we know that there's so many complexities and controversial things that happened in the course of that week. The whole notion of having to had that shelter in place on the day of the Watertown manhunt. I don't think they really accurately explore what the true ramifications of that decision were. And that Tsarnaev was just found a couple hundred yards from where he had last been seen. I mean, there's a lot going on there. But I'm wondering, I mean, I'll go out there and I'll just put out my opinion there. I don't adore the idea of this movie. I don't really love it when Hollywood does, especially in close proximity in time, fictionalize real tragedies. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily Hollywood's duty to be a factual record keeper. So, you know, they're doing what they do best. But do you ever get concerned, Arlene, that there's this idea that for many people who didn't live through it or any historical event that's depicted in Hollywood, that it, in a way, even though it's not meant to be, it kind of becomes a de facto part of the record?
That's exactly what I worry about. And I know that I've fallen prey to it. I love historic dramas. I've watched lots of them. And how many times am I sitting assuming that certain things are fact when, in fact, they're artistic license? I worry about that terrifically for this issue, for this moment, for this event, but for many others. And, you know, your producer, Jamie Maloney, said that we all have these painful real images in our heads about what happened that day. For me, it was very emotional. I was in a total panic. Where are my kids? Are they at the finish line? Are their friends there? In fact, we knew people who were hurt, some very badly. And you want that to be honored and you want it to be respected, but you know it will never come out exactly accurately.
Yeah. The difference between kind of just a movie and a good film is that somehow the good film gives you an additional sense of perspective on something. It illuminates something. It's not clear that this illuminates more rather than just telling a good yarn, if you will. Yeah.
Well, we have just enough time to wrap up This Week in Review with our hubbubs. Some hopefully lighter news, or maybe news that didn't make the top of the fold, as they say. So, Tom, you want to give us your hubbub?
It's not lighter news, but earlier this month, a junior at Tufts University wrote this horrifying first-person account of hazing, sexual misconduct, homophobia, and racial discrimination at one of the campus's fraternities. In response, the school's administration has now embarked on an investigation to see how Greek life can be reformed. My opinion, that's not going to be good enough. The entire idea of Greek life is inherently contrary to the values one would expect of higher education. It's exclusionary, not only on the basis of sex, but also of race, ethnicity, economics, and demographics. Moreover, fraternities and sororities breed a narrow-minded culture of insularity at a place whose mission should be the exact opposite. Forget reform. Instead, it's time, as some former members of a Tufts sorority urged this week, to abolish Greek life altogether.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yes. Yeah, really.
And ladies and gentlemen, it's Tom Keene. You're at Tom Keene, right?
You got it.
Okay. Don't, not at Radio Boston, at Tom Keene. All right. Well, so Tom coming out strong on his opinion about Greek life here. Arlene, your hubbub.
I'm going to give us a lighter touch. I'm going to pivot from the usual hubbub to a more seasonal perspective that's not news-oriented, which is that 'tis the season of the year to try and reach our, again, for our higher selves, to think about the world as it could and should be, about the blessings that we have, about the ways in which we can help people with less good fortune. There is a rabbi at Temple Israel who often says that you should pray like everything depends on God, but, and this is the important line, but act like everything depends on you. So today I say how grateful I am for friends and family and neighbors writ large, as well as the many good fortunes I've enjoyed. But at the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, I will share a gentle reminder in this post-election season, which is being negative is infectious, but so too is the opposite. Being kind, thoughtful, caring encourages other people to do likewise, and it can be extraordinarily powerful. So in these very challenging times, my hope for us all is that we can all be a little better to each other in the coming year, so that when someone encourages us to go low, we manage to find a way to go high in our responses. And let's use this time of year to encourage ourselves, myself included, to listen to our better angels. So I'm wishing all our listeners the very best for the coming year.
Arlene, that was beautiful.
That was nice. Beautiful.
I'm going to change my hubbub right now. No, seriously, my hubbub is going to be that I hope everyone hearing that, and I'm including myself, takes it to heart and puts it to practice in 2017. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, with that, happy New Year and happy holidays to both of you. It's been great having you in the studio all the many times you've both come this year. I'm so happy and so grateful. You're part of the Radio Boston family, and I wish you both the very, very best of the holiday season.
And a happy new year.
Tom,
same here.
I'm going to give you your proper sign-off now. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page, and Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, two of our favorite folks who come in to help us out with the Week in Review. And thanks to all of our other Week in Review members as well who've come in all of this very difficult and long and newsworthy year. Look forward to seeing you all again next year. But that's it for this Week in Review. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.